Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record program number 724, Wiki of the Damned. This program has been recorded on September 5th of the year 2010. We're going to plunge right back in where we left off at the end of Side 1. I've been talking about a very strange cult with more connections than a switchboard, certainly with a lot of power, a lot of money, apparent intelligence connections, and certainly involved in some brutal, highly criminal mind control procedures vis-a-vis the people in that cult. And in particular, the children raised in the cult all have their hair dyed a peroxide slash platinum blonde. It's one of the characteristics of the particular cult. And for reasons I went into in Side 1, I strongly suspect that the ostensibly tangential links of Julian Assange to the cult are actually far more significant than we have been told, and it may very well be that Julian Assange himself is a victim of mind control and may not be aware of this. In any event, talking about the cult, the Santa Kenton Park Association, one of its apostate members whose disclosures ultimately led to the bust of the cult and its grand dame, Anne Hamilton Byrne, was one of Anne Hamilton Byrne's, quote, daughters, unquote, not actually her birth daughter, named Sarah Moore, who wrote a manuscript, Unseen, Unheard, Unknown, about the cult, and we're going to plunge right back in and talk about that. Her account of the cult, and again, notice the fascistic slash totalitarian aspects of this. Also note that the children of the cult were not only had their hair dyed peroxide slash platinum blonde, but they had multiple identities, multiple birth certificates. They were meant to fit in for one another, and ultimately she was busted for documentation fraud, or for forging, basically. Sarah Moore's her manuscript reads in part as follows. My mother was Anne Hamilton Byrne, the leader of a small sect in the Dandenongs called the Family, or the Great White Brotherhood. I was a small part of her plan to collect children in what she herself once called a scientific experiment, unquote. Later, I discovered it was her intention that we children would continue her sect after the earth was consumed by a holocaust. She saw us as the inheritors of the earth, unquote. I didn't know that then. In those days, I was just a child. A child of a guru, but a child no less. 22 to 28 children all lived at Uptop in its heyday, although the Fosters had varying lengths of stay. She used to say that she couldn't remember all the dates very well because she had so many children. Maybe in retrospect, we should have realized that was weird, but then we never thought it was anything out of the ordinary. She decided upon sets of twins and triplets and gave us ages and birth dates to fit in with that idea. Birthday changes were just something you accepted. It was as if Anne knew so much more about everything than us, and she just might be revealing another piece of our life plan if she changed our birthdays. We were the children of the family, the children of Anne Hamilton Byrne. We were dressed alike. Most of the girls' hair was dyed blonde, cut into fringes, and worn long with identical hairstyles and identically colored ribbons. All the boys had bowl haircuts. Why did she raise us in almost total social isolation, miles from anywhere, with minimal contact with other humans apart from the sect members who looked after us? Why did she subject us to the bizarre and cruel regimen in which we grew up? Was it to demonstrate that she had the power to create a generation that would be reared with her beliefs and believing in her? I suspect perhaps that there were more sinister motives than these alone. Some of us had multiple birth certificates and passports and citizenship of more than one country. Only she knows why this was and why we were also dressed alike, why most of us even had our hair dyed identically blonde. I can only conjecture because I will never know for sure. However, I suspect that she went to such great lengths in order to enable her to move children around in and out of the country, perhaps even to be sold overseas. I'm sure there is a market somewhere in the world for small, blonde children with no traceable identities. If she did it, it was a perfect scam. Many ex-sect members said that they were aware that Anne was creating children by a breeding program in the late 1960s. These were invisible kids, unquote, because they had no papers and there is no proof that they ever existed. Yet, we Hamilton Byrne children had multiple identities. These identities could perhaps have been loaned to other children and the similarity of our appearance used to cover up their absence. One little blonde kid looks very like another in a passport photo. I don't suppose we will ever know the truth because only Anne Hamilton Byrne knows the truth about the whole affair, and the truth is something she will never tell. So note that, and note too that among the places that Julian Assange wound up was Sweden, more about Sweden and that fascist milieu there. He's being charged with harassment or molestation, not quite rape, but I wonder to what extent it's pure rumination. I wonder whether some of the dark fascist-connected sex trafficking networks involving people who were immigrants from other countries that Stieg Larsson wrote about and fictionalized with fictionalized cover. I wonder if that might enter in here. Note also that Tiger Woods' mother-in-law was the Swedish Minister of Immigration. And as we've looked at in some recent programs and also in a number of Food for Thought posts on the SpitfireList.com website, the issue of immigration, sex trafficking, and a lot of very dark things indeed go all the way to the highest echelons of Swedish society. And there's a profound, powerful fascist and Nazi milieu in Sweden, one that dates back decades. But going back to the Anne Hamilton Byrne cult, the family, more about the attitudes of the cult and mind control. And this this again is from Sarah Moore's autobiography, from her autobiography basically. I have mentioned earlier the alarming drug dependency of this sect and how we were constantly administered prescription drugs. There was always a lot of medical paraphernalia around up top, syringes, tablets, gauges, and more. I remember one whole cupboard containing hundreds of bottles of homeopathic medicines. This cupboard was in the downstairs girls' room, and one summer we broke in and stole lots of this homeopathy because the pills were sugar-coated and tasted like lollies. Skipping down. For us, Anne wanted people to believe we were her children, and she thought she was beautiful, so it was a certainty that she screened us on our looks, or at least screened our parents. We were to be the ones who would carry out the work of the sect. We were a direct reflection on her, so she was intimately concerned about our appearances. She used to talk a lot about breeding, unquote, and talk about us being from the, quote, right stock, unquote, with the blonde hair. Again, this is a quasi-Aryan slash Nazi overtone to some of this here. Continuing with this, Anne was always a very rich woman who never spared herself anything. Lately, though, she's been crying poor, but judging by all the real estate she owns throughout the world, I estimate she is worth at least $150 million. Then there's a discussion of the many pricey properties she owns all over the world, and it's very pricey indeed. Skipping down again, once initiated came the go-through, and that meant LSD trips. Everyone knew that it was an inevitable consequence of initiation, one of the rituals that was integral to the spiritual development of the new initiate. I've been present at many go-throughs of people in the sect and ended up having at least a dozen myself. During a go-through, you were supposed to look at yourself and see the badness inside to regress to significant incidents in childhood and in previous lives which affected your personality and retarded your spiritual development. The drug, which Anne sometimes called the herb or the dream medicine, was meant to make this easier. It was also meant to make the spiritual bonding easier between master and disciple. You were supposed to recognize her as the one true master, Christ incarnate. She would come into people when they were under and ask, "Do you know who I am?" The correct answer was, "The Lord incarnate." The incorrect answer meant you weren't working hard enough. Working was looking at yourself and realizing what a horrible person you were, repenting for your sins and purifying yourself. Before my first go-through, I was deprived of sleep for several nights and made to read yoga and the Bible. Beforehand, I'd watched one of my brothers get down on his knees and beg me not to hate him for being a closet homosexual. This confession had been wrung out of him by Ann after several days of intensive working under LSD. He felt that he was a failure, and I did my best to tell him that he'd never be a failure to me because I loved him. We were all scared of revealing our weaknesses, but doubted that we would be able to hold anything back once under the influence of the drugs. Anne's technique, pretty typically, of keeping us awake for several days before a go-through, meant that we were incredibly vulnerable anyway. You have to hand it to Anne. She knew her stuff. This was chronic sleep deprivation, and it added to the strain of the whole experience. Even today, I find if I am really tired, I'm prone to flashbacks of LSD, and it's harder to cope than it should be. Add to that the sensory deprivation, for I was placed in a quiet and dark room and never knew whether it was day or night. Plus, what I'm not going to go into, then in the description for the program, the various abusive practices of the cult will be gone into, but they are legion. There's beating, sexual humiliation, molestation, pretty much you name it, and it's here. And again, this isn't just a bunch of weirdos and a bunch of sickos. This appears to be some sort of intelligence front, and this may very well be some sort of British intelligence or Australian branch of British intelligence version of or variant of some of the MKUltra mind control programs that CIA and other intelligence services in this country had gone into. An interesting detail here was provided by Sarah Moore. It has been suggested that Anne would have had no power without a syringe. She claimed a lot of knowledge of medical things. She said she had been the matron of a hospital, but there is no evidence she ever did any nursing. I can't emphasize the importance of nursing in this sect enough. It was critical to the way she viewed the aunties, and it was what she planned for the girl's future profession. She said nursing was one of the ideal occupations because it was a form of selfless service that led to spiritual advancement. We knew that on their weeks off from up top, the aunties were either training to be nurses or practiced as nurses. Several of the aunties nursed Lord Casey, former Governor General of Australia. Rumor has it that he made a significant donation to the sect. And from a biography from a university source, and this will be annotated on in the description for the program, who was Lord Casey? In public, Casey seemed to be a devoted Cold War warrior, fervently supportive of Britain and the USA, and deeply hostile towards the Soviet Union and China. He was the minister responsible for the Australian Secret Service. So again, an interesting person to be involved with this cult. And again, one wonders, you know, if he supposedly was treated by them after an automobile accident, you would have think that one would have thought that he would have been able to afford a different medical care. Still more from Sarah Moore's discussion. And here again, we get into some of the interesting power connections of this cult. The bulk of the sect was made up of professional people. Without their support and participation, Anne Hamilton Byrne would never have become what she is today. It was their names, or most importantly, the letters that went after their names, that gave her the credibility and social power that she needed. It gave her the means to keep those she already had and to get more and similar people into the cult. These professional people, doctors, lawyers, engineers, architects, psychiatrists, nurses, and social workers, allowed her successfully to pull the wool over everyone's eyes for more than 20 years. Had the family been a group of strangely dressed people meeting once or twice a week for meditation and address by the master, playing of music and chanting, they would never have gone unnoticed for so long. But pinstripe professionals in their conservative suits with their impeccable social credentials could get away with maintaining in their private life morals that were completely at variance with their professional ethics. They looked respectable, people thought, therefore they must be respectable. Who were these professionals? They were doctors who wrote out the prescriptions that controlled us, lawyers who wrote out the deed polls that were needed to forge passports and birth certificates that created our false identities, social workers who allowed Anne to bypass normal channels to allow her to adopt or simply steal, in some instances, 16 children, doctors and nurses who gave her contacts with rich dying people who then left their estates to her. It was the same doctors who signed their death certificates. Psychiatrists who had people committed to New Haven, the family-owned psychiatric hospital, and doctors and nurses who supervised the abuse of LSD, which for a while they actually obtained free of charge from the Swiss drug company, Sandoz. Sandoz, by the way, is part of the IG Farben complex. And we've looked at that in connection with a number of things. So note, again, the profound professional connections of this particular group. Notice the things they were able to do and the exact numbers of children that were in their breeding programs, their adoption programs. Who knows? Because, again, multiple identities, false documentation were legion with this particular organization. And, again, the striking feature of the organization's initiates, children, offspring, whatever you want to call them, where they all have their hair dyed this weird sort of peroxide platinum blonde. And, again, this is a mind control cult with some very sophisticated connections, apparent intelligence connections. And I strongly suspect that Julian Assange is deeply connected to the cult, although officially, ostensibly, his connections are very tangential. And as I stated in side one, it's not necessarily casting aspersions on him. This one of the things insidious about mind control is you can be something that you do not realize. You can even be something that you hate, and you will not be aware of it. So it's very, very insidious indeed. More about Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. This from the New Yorker article that we dealt with in Side 1. It's called No Secrets by Rafi Khachaturian from June 7th of 2010. And we're going to get into now some of the political philosophy, to the extent that there is one, around WikiLeaks. Skipping down. In December of 2006, WikiLeaks posted its first document, a secret decision signed by Sheikh Hassan Dahir Awais, a Somali rebel leader for the Islamic Courts Union that had been culled from traffic passing through the Tor network to China. The document called for the execution of government officials by hiring criminals as hitmen. Assange and the others were uncertain of its authenticity, but they thought that readers using Wikipedia-like features of the site would help analyze it. They published the decision with a lengthy commentary which asked, is it a bold manifesto by a flamboyant Islamic militant with links to bin Laden, or a clever smear by U.S. intelligence designed to discredit the Union, fracture Somali alliances, and manipulate China? Well, the Islamic courts don't really need anybody to discredit them. During the World Cup earlier this summer, they arrested a bunch of Somali youth for watching a World Cup match on television. The charge was that they were wasting time. Actions like that basically do a better job of discrediting the Islamic courts. I mention that because when one looks at much of what WikiLeaks has done to date, it winds up bolstering the Islamist cause. And indeed, they've posted information supportive of rebels in Chechnya, and more about that in the description for the program. And also, this is not the first show I'll be doing about WikiLeaks, but in terms of their political outlook, it is ostensibly sort of left libertarian. They were invited to the World Social Forum, which has a socialist outlook. But when one actually gets down to the worldview that they're presenting, well, it's very interesting. Skipping down in this New Yorker article, we read, Assange, despite his claims to scientific journalism, emphasized to me that his mission is to expose injustice, not to provide an even-handed record of events. In an invitation to potential collaborators in 2006, he wrote, and this is very significant, quote, our primary targets are those highly oppressive regimes in China, Russia, and Central Asia, in other words, the Earth Island that I was talking about in For the Record program 723, the last show, but we also expect to be assistance to those in the West who wish to reveal illegal or immoral behavior in their own government and corporations. He has argued that the social movement to expose secrets could bring down many administrations that rely on concealing reality, including the U.S. administration. In this regard, I would, before we continue, I would note that he's basically caused a lot of problems for the Obama administration and is sort of contributing to the double bind that the Obama administration is in as they attempt, as Obama attempts to deal with a depression and two wars, all started by his predecessor. He's being attacked from right and the left for not being far enough in either direction. And certainly, whatever the intent of Julian Assange and the WikiLeaks people, and bear in mind the possible mind control factor here, whatever their intent, their actions to date have basically wound up making things still tougher for Obama and easier for his enemies as a result. Still more about this organization. Assange does not recognize the limits that traditional publishers do. Recently, he posted military documents that included the social security numbers of soldiers and in the bunker, parenthetically, of their headquarters. I asked him if WikiLeaks' mission would have been compromised if he had redacted these small bits. He said that some leaks risked harming innocent people, collateral damage, if you will, but that he could not weigh the importance of every detail in every document. Perhaps the social security numbers would one day be important to researchers investigating wrongdoing, he said. By releasing the information, he would allow judgments to occur in the open. A year and a half ago, WikiLeaks published the results of an army test conducted in 2004 of electromagnetic devices designed to prevent IEDs from being triggered. The document revealed key aspects of how the devices functioned and also showed that they interfered with communication systems used by soldiers, information that an insurgent could exploit. By the time WikiLeaks published the study, the Army had begun to deploy newer technology, but some soldiers were still using those devices. I asked Assange if he would refrain from releasing information that he knew might get someone killed. He said that he had instituted a harm minimization policy, unquote, where people named in certain documents were contacted before publication to warn them, but that there were also instances where the members of WikiLeaks might get, quote, blood on our hands, unquote, skipping down. In 2007, he published thousands of pages of secret military information detailing a vast number of army procurements in Iraq and Afghanistan. He and a volunteer spent weeks building a searchable database, studying the Army's purchasing codes, and adding up the cost of the procurements, billions of dollars in all. The database cataloged material that every unit had ordered, machine guns, Humvees, cash counting machines, satellite phones. Assange hoped the journalists would pour through it, but barely any did. I am so angry, he said. This was such a effing fantastic leak. The Army's force structure of Afghanistan and Iraq down to the last chair and nothing, unquote. WikiLeaks is a finalist for a Knight Foundation grant of more than $500,000. The intended project would set up a way for sources to pass documents to newspaper reporters securely. WikiLeaks would serve as a kind of numbered Swiss bank account where information could be anonymously exchanged. The system would allow the source to impose a deadline on the reporter, after which the document would automatically appear on WikiLeaks. Well, bear in mind some of the stuff that he's been publishing here about even individual social security numbers of active duty military personnel and some highly classified things. Bear in mind, too, everybody, who knows what they've got a hold of that they have not made public. This could have some very serious consequences. Aside from getting individuals killed, you start publicizing sensitive national security documents, who knows who is going to get a hold of them, and who knows what they're going to do with them when they get a hold of them, and it may be that neither Julian Assange nor WikiLeaks really knows just exactly who's getting a hold of things. In that context, the following. Swedish web hosting firm confirms WikiLeaks link. This is by Carl Ritter of the Associated Press from MSNBC.com from August 6th of 2010. A Swedish internet company linked to file sharing hub The Pirate Bay says it's helping online whistleblower WikiLeaks release classified documents from servers located in a Stockholm suburb. Michael Viborg, the owner of the web hosting company PRQ, on Friday showed the Associate Press the site, the basement of a drab office building in Solna, on the condition that the exact location was not revealed. So again, note that this is the file sharing hub of Pirate Bay as well. What I find interesting about that is the following, a little bit about Pirate Bay. This is an article from the British Register by Andrew Orlowski from February 26th of 2009, Pirate Bay's Neo-Nazi Sugar Daddy. The trial of the Pirate Bay operators in Sweden has generated huge amounts of media coverage, but one of the most interesting things about Pirate Bay hasn't gotten a mention. In his daily dispatches for Wired, court correspondent Oscar Schwartz swoons over the boyish charm of likable and winning Pirate Bay PR guy Peter Sund. But there seems to be something about Pirate Bay that no one wants you to read, in debt to one of the most notorious fascists in Europe. Regular readers will already know a little about Carl Lundstrom's background, but as Andrew Brown, author of the autobiographical Fishing in Utopia, points out, no English-language coverage of the trial has mentioned this. Thanks to Brown's blog, we know a little more about Lundstrom. For example, Lundstrom was linked to a gang of skinheads that attacked Latin American tourists in Stockholm in the mid-1980s. Over the years, Lundstrom has switched his support from Keep Sweden Swedish to the far-right headbangers party New Democracy, but was thrown out for being too right-wing. He's currently bankrolling 100 candidates for the Swedish equivalent of the BNP. Lundstrom is alleged to own 40% of the Pirate Bay, the largest share, and gave it servers and bandwidth to get going. Well, one of the things that I find interesting about this, aside from Lundstrom himself, it's not clear. This is the PRQ that also handles the WikiLeaks site. It's not totally clear to me if that means that PRQ is also routing all of the leaked documents that people send anonymously to WikiLeaks, but that certainly sounds possible. And it appears probable to me that the link with Pirate Bay would allow this neo-Nazi's company access to all of the documents to which WikiLeaks has access. And it may be that Julian Assange and the WikiLeaks people are not fully aware of just who they're dealing with or the possible implications. And again, when you're dealing in a situation in which mind control is manifest, who knows? Another interesting thing, too, about Lundstrom is that his largesse, as indicated in his Wikipedia entry, Carl Lundstrom is the son of Ulf Lundstrom and the grandson of Carl Edward Lundstrom, founder of the world's largest crisp bread producer, Wasabröd. When his father, Ulf Lundstrom, died in 1973, Carl Lundstrom was one of five heirs to Wasabröd and its subsidiary, OLW. In 1982, Wasabröd was sold to the Swiss pharmaceutical company Sandoz, making Lundstrom a fortune. Well, Sandoz is part of the old IG complex. It's the parent company of LSD, and it's also the company that was supplying LSD, according to Sarah Moore, free to the Hamilton Byrne cult as well. So just what exactly this Pirate Bay connection gives this Swedish Nazi milieu access to, it appears probable from what I know of computers that it would be next to impossible for WikiLeaks to keep this from them, given what's capable technologically. We're going to be exploring all of this at greater length, too. I'm going to be doing at least one more program about WikiLeaks. I also want to stress that, as in is the case with so many of these broadcasts, this is interrogatory in nature. I still have more questions than answers. But one thing I am absolutely convinced of, and I think the evidence argues overwhelmingly in that regard, is that there is far more to the WikiLeaks situation than meets the eye. Their funder, by the way, their funding seems to come through an apparently innocent Berlin-based Wow Holland Foundation that is named for an iconic German hacker. And apparently only a little bit of the money they raise for WikiLeaks is ever used. Where does the money go? What's taking place? I do not know. Perhaps in a future broadcast we'll explore that, but that's all we have time for in this one. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record program number 724, Wiki of the Damned. This program is being recorded on September 5th of the year 2010. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.